meet you.
House Committee on Sustainability and Economic Development come to order. It's April 16th. Thank you for your attendance. We have a full agenda. Just as a note, I suspect a lot of you are here for House Bill 2015. We have several other items that we're going to take up first because I think they will go quickly, and then we'll get back to House Bill 2015. So we'll start with a public hearing on House Concurrent Resolution 7. Or if you could give us a little summary. Senator Bonamici is here, and I know Gary Conkling was outside, so hopefully they will both make it forward. Please, Senator.
HCR 7 expresses appreciation for Mary Alice Ford's service to the state of Oregon.
I also see Peggy Lynch on our list, so if you'd like to come forward, too, please. Senator, thank you for journeying over.
Thank you. Chair Reed, members of the committee, I'm Suzanne Bonamici. I represent Senate District 17 in the Oregon Senate. I'm here today on House Concurrent Resolution Number 7 to honor Mary Alice Ford. And it's with a combination of a feeling of honor and then also a great feeling of sadness. We need to honor Mary Alice Ford for her work in the legislature, but sadness because of her passing, which was just this past Thanksgiving. The resolution has information about Mary Alice's accomplishments. She served in the Oregon legislature starting in 1981. She served 8 terms in the legislature. She spent 16 years here in the House. And she won numerous awards and really distinguished herself as a leader on issues involving human services, seniors, and mental illness. I've lived in Washington County for a long time, and I knew of her reputation as a leader in those areas, but I didn't actually meet her until 2006 when I was running for the House. And I got to talk with her about what it was like to serve in the legislature, and she really became a role model for me. She encouraged me. She gave me so much information and support. Soon after I met her, she had her first stroke, and when I went to visit her in the convalescent center, I got to see really what a remarkable woman she was, and it was so Mary Alice because I walked in, and there she was at the table in her wheelchair talking to everyone at the lunch table about politics and about what it was like in the legislature and about state government, and that was just the kind of person she was. She was involved in the Washington County Public Affairs Forum, and I had the opportunity to see her. I attend whenever I can during the interim, and she was a regular member and attendee. In fact, she chaired the forum for a while. And we'd typically talk about government or politics or whatever was on the agenda, but we rarely talked about personal things like our families. I did know her son, Tom, because Tom is involved in the forum as well. At Mary Alice's service, I got to meet her other son, John, who was up from California, and also her daughter, Sherilyn. And we realized at that time that I was talking with Mary Alice's daughter that we actually had some things in common, and Mary Alice's daughter and my daughter actually know each other from the theater community. And what that said to me is it's a small world story, but it also said that there was so much more that we could have talked about. Mary Alice had a wealth of information. She did so much for her community in the legislature, in the local community, statewide, and also nationally. I know that then-President Reagan appointed her to a commission. She was truly a role model for me, and as a Democrat, having that sort of encouragement and a mentor and a woman who served as a Republican member and who is known for her bipartisanship and ability to work across the aisle, that really says a lot about the kind of values that Mary Alice had and her character. So I encourage you to support House Concurrent Resolution 7, to send it to the floor with a do-adopt recommendation so that we can join together to acknowledge the contributions of this remarkable woman, Mary Alice Ford. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Ordinarily, I like to hear from the whole panel before we take questions, but I know you have a busy schedule, so ask if there are any questions for you. And if
thank
not,
you. I will stay for this panel. Thank
okay.
you, Mr.
Okay.
Chair.
Thanks very much. Thank you, Gary.
Peggy Lynch, I'm a private citizen wearing this hat today, former resident of Washington County and now Benton County, but a long time a longtime acquaintance, friend, and fellow worker with Mary Alice Ford, and she will be missed. Most of what you have heard from Senator Bonamici is exactly who Mary Alice was. She would be so pleased with the attendance here today on yet another issue that you're dealing with, simply because she believed in the process and she believed in the public being a part of the process and advocated very hard for all of us to do that. She was a bipartisan representative. She certainly had a wonderful elephant collection, one of the best I have ever seen. And she took her principles and her stance on positions very seriously. But she came here to work for all of Oregon. And one of the things that we can really thank Mary Alice for is for the adult foster care system we have here in Oregon. For those of you who may have an adult foster care home in your neighborhood, so that your friends and neighbors can have a place to be that is not in a nursing home, you should say thank you to Mary Alice, because she helped make that happen. So as all of you work on legislation here in the future, I hope that you can find at least one thing that when you leave your service that you can say, I did that for Oregon, because certainly Mary Alice did. One of the things that I knew her about was when Washington County developed their comprehensive plans, they divided the county into 13 groups. And Mary Alice and I both lived in the Westlope, Raleigh Hills, Garden Home area of Washington County, known as CPO3, a community planning organization and then a citizen participation organization. One of the things that the CPO has done over the years is awarded people certificates that said, as a result of his or her efforts, our neighborhoods are a better place for our families. For Mary Alice, we can say, as a result of her efforts, Oregon is a better place for our families. So I encourage you to pass this resolution. Mary Alice was a wonderful human being.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Mr. Conkling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Gary Conkling. I'm also appearing today as a citizen and a constituent in Representative Ford's district. I appreciated her as my representative when she served, but in my other role, which is standing around in these halls and trying to persuade you of different points of view, I also admired her for her principles. I can't think of once where Mary Alice didn't tell you exactly what she thought. And it wasn't always what I wanted to hear, but I always appreciated hearing it because it came unvarnished and I knew where I stood. It also helped me understand if I wanted to get her vote, the context in which I had to put my issue, how I had to frame it or how I had to shape it so that she would be supportive. And as I think my fellow witnesses have said, she was a person who could be flexible. She didn't necessarily base her principles based on which party you were at, where you were from, who you are, or what your background was. She was a person who based it on how much sense you made. There's not enough of that. I miss that. Not that you all aren't of the same strain, but the whole process overall today probably needs to step back and ask that question more often. Does it make sense? Will it help people? I miss her for that, and I respect her for that, and I hope you will pass this resolution to remember her for that and many other accomplishments. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Conkling. Any questions for this panel? Seeing none, I appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
Thank you for hearing us.
Just counting to make sure we have a quorum here before we close the public hearing and move to a work session. It appears that we do. So is there anyone else who wants to be heard on House Concurrent Resolution 7? Seeing none, close the public hearing and open a work session on House Concurrent Resolution 7. Representative Benz?
Mr. Chair, I move House Concurrent Resolution 7 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Benz moves House Concurrent Resolution 7 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, motion carries. House Concurrent Resolution 7 moves to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. I will carry with Representative Hanna And with that, we'll close the work session on House Concurrent Resolution 7. And we will wait for just a brief moment, Representative Bailey's return, before we go into a work session on House Bill 2626. So stand at ease for just a moment. There wasn't a long recess. Welcome back, Representative Bailey. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2626. This is the bill known as EAST, Energy Efficiency and Sustainable Technologies, the one that you may have used if you had any trouble sleeping on the weekend, 60 pages plus. Representative Bailey, perhaps you can bring us up to speed on where we stand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Colleagues, we have a Dash 3 amendment to House Bill 2626, which is the vast majority of the bill. There are a couple of technical tweaks that still need to happen in the bill, particularly related to bonding and to some provisions with consumer-owned utilities. But these are issues that will that are generally the purview of the Revenue Committee, and as this bill has a subsequent referral to Revenue and then to Ways and Means, we are hoping to move the Dash 3s and get this over to Revenue so we can start the clock over there and allow that committee to dive in and do its work and make sure that we're addressing any additional concerns on the bill. So, and Mr. Chair, my understanding on that is that in order to do that, we're going to have to rescind the Dash 1 amendment, which was the original gut and stuff of the bill, and instead do the Dash 3, which is the corrected and updated gut and stuff. Is that correct?
I understand that the same way you do, Representative Bailey. So we'll move to that a little bit later. I want to give everybody a chance to have any discussion or comments about the bill before we have that. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is an important bill. It's a very important piece of public policy. Representative Bailey has already said there are some issues that remain with the consumer-owned utilities, and I have every confidence that those will be able to be addressed over in the Revenue Committee.
Thank you, Representative Witt. Other comments? Any discussion? Seeing none. Representative Bailey?
Mr. Chair, I move we reconsider the vote by which the House Bill 2626-1 amendments dated March 31st were adopted.
Thank you. Representative Bailey moves to reconsider the vote by which the committee adopted the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2626, dated March 31st. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, the motion carries. And Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move to adopt the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2626, dated April 14th.
Thank you. Representative Bailey moves to adopt the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2626, dated April 14th. Is there any discussion on that motion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing no objection, the Dash 3 amendments are adopted. Representative Bailey?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2626 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committees on Revenue and then Ways and Means by prior reference.
Thank you. Representative Bailey moves House Bill 2626 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Revenue and then the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Any discussion? Seeing none. Any objection? Seeing none. Motion carries. House Bill 2626 moves to the floor with the due pass recommendation and to the Committee on Revenue and Ways and Means by prior reference. Thank you for your diligence and persistence on a big bill. I'm confident it's going to result in a good product. That closed the work session on House Bill 2626. And as I shift papers around a bit, we will open a work session on House Bill 3039 and ask for a brief summary.
HB 3039 requires the Public Utility Commission to undertake a study of qualifying renewable energy projects and report their findings to the 76th Legislative Assembly, repeals the Act on January 2, 2012.
Thank you. This is another work in process. The committee's been relatively engaged on the discussion that's ongoing. I have a couple people here to give us an update on those discussions. And is our sound going okay still? I got a signal from the back. So we'll have a little update on House Bill 3039. I think Dave Vantoff is here, I hope, and perhaps Desiree Strader as well. We open up 21-21.
Yes.
While we await their arrival, let's simultaneously open a work session on House Bill 2121. That's on the same general topic. I believe there's some other folks who'd like to be heard on that as well and explain the amendments that are in place there. We have -2 amendments for 2121, which is a summary on that.
HB 2121 directs the Public Utility Commission to develop a pilot program to integrate up to 17 megawatts of electricity generated from solar power into the state's existing electrical power grid, directs the PUC to adopt rules to establish the program, grants the PUC the ability to make production incentive payments to solar energy producers.
So, committee, we have two bills that are taking on the same general topic with a couple of different approaches. The -2 amendments to 2121 are here. We can discuss those. And the -4 amendments are underway for 3039. We don't have them in front of us yet. So hopefully before we close these two work sessions, we'll have a chance to get a general description of those. But while we are here with the -2s to 2121 in front of us, is there any discussion on those? Perhaps to get us started, I just received a note that Joe Esmond would like to give us a quick note on 2121 and 3039. They're both open in work session. Is Mr. Esmond here? Seeing none.
Mr. Chair, I believe he's right out in the hall.
Okay. Let's stand at ease for a moment while we seek him out. Oh, here he is. Here he is. Mr. Esmond, please come forward. So far, you're the only one who's indicated an interest
like
at the moment. We have work sessions open on both House Bill 2121 and House Bill 3039. I know you've been involved in the discussion thus far, so I'd be happy to hear from you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Joe Resin with the IBW Local 48 in Portland, Oregon. We find that this is a very good bill. We are more than anxious to get going, to have huge solar projects going, either from the, say, for the House districts or maybe out over in Eastern Oregon. So I've been working with some people over on this stuff for about 8-9 years. So very encouraged to see this move. This is a good bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions? Done a good job. Were you referring specifically to 2121 or 3039, or do you have
both?
Do you have feelings on one or the other?
Feelings?
Your thoughts, I should say.
I'm a man. I don't have feelings. I'm supporting both.
Very good. Seeing no questions. Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Stand at ease for just a moment. Mr. Strader, would you like to come forward and give us a little update? And I see Mr. Beyer lurking in the back there as well. We have work sessions open on both House Bill 2121 and House Bill 3039. What I'm hoping you might be able to do is give us a brief summary on the conversations that are ongoing and the amendments that are forthcoming on House Bill 3039. We have the 2121-2s in front of us for review.
Chair Reed and members of the committee. My name is Desiree Strader. I'm the executive director of OSEA. And as of this morning, we have dash four amendments that we are waiting to come out of legislative council. After much discussion and meetings with stakeholders, including the governor's office and Chair Reed, these were based on a meeting we had on Friday with Chair Reed and other leaders of the industry and OSEA board members. What you can expect out of the dash four amendments is in section two, the 200, let me continue.
Please,
oh, sorry.
Please.
The 250 megawatt nameplate has been negotiated down to a 20 megawatt nameplate to get the utilities into solar. The 2121-2 amendments of the PBI, the production-based incentive, have been put back into HB 3039 with of a 25 megawatt pilot project with 75% allotted for residential and 25% commercial, with during the rulemaking process in which the PUC will have jurisdiction over, that they can look at those numbers and make sure they're actually in line with the market demand and the ability to fulfill that capacity by 2015. Also on the 20 megawatt to note is a 2-to-1 multiplier that I think is under the RPS. And the reasoning being there is that if you look at the RPS, in part of the negotiations, 8% of that was supposed to be allotted towards small-scale community projects under 20 megawatt. Currently, that is also being mostly met by large-scale wind. And as you know, the current RPS also at the 25% towards utilities is also being met by large-scale wind. So of that, solar currently makes up 0.03 of 1% of the 8%. So this is a way for us to level the playing field within renewables. This could also be something that WAVE would look at, as well as geothermal. And we're really looking at this as an installer's bill, in that it's not only job-created focus, but it also will eventually move the industry to hopefully being off the Betsy by 2012. And this will be an additional tool in our toolbox.
Thank you very much. Any questions from Ms. Strader?
I don't know if it's a question for you or it was just a question. I'm going to throw it out there. You can answer it or not. I guess we'll find out. But remind me about the RPS. Was that we're supposed to get 25% renewable?
By 2025.
Okay. Renewable for what's generated in the state or what's used in the state? Please remind me.
It's to be what's generated in the state and also what's to be used in the state. But more importantly, the 25% renewable portfolio standard, hence has the word portfolio. So we would like to see the ability for other renewables to be included in that.
Well, then my next question would be how many kilowatts, megawatts, whatever measure you want to put to it, is generated in the state?
I notice we have Mr. Beyer in the back. Should we
would you like to come
forward and help answer those questions? Mr. Chair? We just had a question. I'm not sure if you overheard it about the total load for the state, what's generated in state, that sort of thing. So it's hard to imagine someone who'd be better positioned to answer that sort of question. Would you like to repeat it?
Well, what I'm trying to get at is we just last session established a 25% RPS. Okay. And so I just asked the question whether that was of generated or what's used here in the state. It's of generated. I'm wondering how much power is generated in the state. So how I'm just trying to figure out
a sense of scale.
What is this? Yeah. What is the 25%? What is that? How does that relate to megawatts or however you want to measure it here?
Do you have a sense of that? Chair Reed, Representative Thatcher, my name's Lee Sparling. I'm Director of the Utility Program at the Public Utility Commission. I can give you a clear answer to the first part of your question, and that is that the RPS applies to not the amount that's generated in the state, but the percent the resources that are used to serve customers in the state. So a utility can meet part of its RPS requirement with a renewable resource, a wind plant, for example, that is out of state. It's just a question of where the kilowatt hours come from or how they're generated to meet the needs of customers in the state. Now, as far as how much that is, I'm winging this a little bit based on what I think I know. For Portland General Electric, their total system load is about 2,000 average megawatts. Now, I'm sorry, an average megawatt is a term that we use to describe a certain number of megawatt hours provided over the course of the year. Obviously, 25% of that in 2025 would be about 500 average megawatts. To translate that into megawatt hours, you have to multiply that out quite a bit. So it's hard for me to give you a simple answer on that right now that's going to be very helpful. And if you wish, I'm certainly able to follow up and provide you in writing the answer by the end of the day.
And it's also worth noting that number changes as population and our use of electricity changes as well. Isn't that
yes.
true? Thank you. You have both.
So we would project that to be higher by the time we're supposed to have implemented this 25%. Okay, so we would have to project out. But I guess what I'm getting at is what are we looking at for trying to accomplish meeting this goal as far as renewables? How many? I mean, what are we looking at? I'm just trying to get a picture in my head of how many acres of wind farms we're going to have, how many acres, how many rooftops covered with solar power.
I can make one general comment, and then the panel can respond more specifically. It seems to me that part of the RPS is to stimulate new forms of renewable energy that could come in lots of different forms. Solar is one of those, and so I think the legislature in the last session, of which some of us were members, had the discussion about the RPS as a whole. What we're talking about in these bills, and there's nothing wrong with asking these questions and questioning ourselves and so on, is what place solar has in that larger discussion. So I'd be happy to have your comments on that.
But we can just get those answers later, since I know we have a PAC committee. I would just...
Mr. Chair, if I might,
please.
For the record, Lee Beyer, Chair of the Oregon Public Utility Commission. I think I would have, from our perspective, we would have a little different take on that. We see the RPS is the legislature setting a constraint, if you will, saying at least 25% of your power by 2025 will be met by renewables, not any particular source. So we put that in the context of, as we look at all resources, we see our job as being, if you will, economic watchdogs for the consumers. And so we would approach it in saying we are going to get the least cost resource within the constraints the legislature puts on for the ratepayers. So if we're looking at renewables, for example, we'll look and say, what's the cheapest renewable the utilities can bring in, matching up other things like diversity and that, and meet the 25% goal.
I appreciate that refinement. It's a more articulate way of saying what I was trying to say, in that the RPS was the discussion in the last session. Our discussion on these bills is what role solar has in that. So I appreciate the way you said that. Other questions? Representative Benz?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Beyer, you had expressed comments or some concern about the -1 amendments. Have you now... I guess we're up to -4. Is that where we are now?
Yes.
We're waiting on -4.
That's right.
But and you've been involved in the creation of the -4 amendments. Is that a correct statement? Or the question is, are you?
Mr. Chair, Representative Vance, I wouldn't say that I've been involved in creation of the -4s. I'd say I'm somewhat aware. I mean, I was sent them by Representative Reed's staff earlier today, so I had just a very cursory chance to look at them. They're, from the commission perspective, they're better because the number's lower, but we still have the same concern about going beyond a pilot project which we've really seen as a way to provide the legislature and frankly, your next session and other ones with sort of an apples-to-apples so you can say, what's the best way to meet the renewable portfolio standard? What's the way to do that? That's kind of what we're looking at and try to learn more about solar. Going beyond that and setting an aggressive goal, the concern I have is given today, and I don't want this to come off as anti-solar because I don't intend it to be, today's cost at today's technology, it's a very expensive resource. You can't bring it into the portfolio unless you require it without a substantial subsidy, and it's your decision to decide where you're going to get that subsidy from.
Please. Going back, we had a I think it was a 3-to-1 credit. Do you know, has that now, is that still in the dash four?
I can answer that. It is not. It is not. The current discussion is around a 2-to-1. And let me just clarify. My hope today is that we can adopt the dash two amendments to House Bill 2121. The bill as it was, as 2121 was originally written was, I think most would acknowledge, something of a placeholder. So 2121 is further refining that. We're obviously not ready. We don't have the amendments to that, to 3039. Adopting the dash two amendments would allow the fiscal and revenue to be prepared, and we can come back and continue the conversation after today. So I think we should continue today as long as there are questions, but just to make sure that that's my intent for today. Representative Whitler, did you follow up?
One final one.
Sure.
The pilot program approach as opposed to, I guess I'll back up, is the current approach as you understand it under the dash four amendments a pilot program, or is it something different than that?
Could you ask that again?
Is it?
Which bill are we referring to?
I'm back to, I'm actually back to 3039.
Okay.
My question is, the pilot project approach appeals to me, and I'm just wondering if that's, is that what I heard you say, you also were looking for a pilot project as opposed to something more aggressive than that?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Vance, my understanding of the dash threes, and I'm not sure about the dash four proposal, the dash threes has more or less the 2121 pilot as part of it, but it also has, and that's at a target level of 25, up to 25 megawatts, but it also has, in the dash three, it also had a additional 20 megawatts for large-scale projects of larger than 500 kilowatts up, I'm not sure if there was a cap, but up to 250 on it, megawatts that would be, and I think it was primarily targeted towards more what I would call industrial applications, either operated by a utility or a third party and sold to a utility. So latter piece that we've expressed concerns about.
Sure.
Please. Actually, it's a maximum of 100 megawatt over the megawatts over the 4-year program on the 20 megawatt, and it's a max. It's not just the 500 kilowatt. It's also a maximum at 5 megawatt per project.
Okay. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Leah, first of all, Mr. Chairman, we're still open under 3039.
We are.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, are you still opposed to rolling 3039 into 2121 or combining the two?
The
other way around. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, yes.
And could, Mr. Chairman,
please,
could you briefly explain that, the basis for that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, I'll try. Again, where we started from is a perspective of you have a fairly aggressive solar program going right now that uses tax subsidies and energy trust payments, and that has been bringing quite a bit on, and frankly through that the subsidy on a residential application, you're buying about the collectively about 2/3 of the cost of the installation. We also have a program that allows third-party vendors. You may have heard it. We issued a ruling last year that allowed third-party vendors to come in and do net metering. was it Honeywell? I'm losing the Honeywell Corporation was the name that was thrown around out there, putting them up on commercial buildings, and that has been going fairly well. Again, that's dependent on the use of tax credits as a subsidy from both state and federal sources. What we were convinced, and frankly the governor was very interested in testing this, was doing a pilot that would set up to see, is it better to use what's called in Europe a feed-in tariff, which essentially allows a recognition of the value of the resource to the system, which would be greater than just the energy generated. There are other values that go with that. Recognize that and then determine how much more is necessary to profitably enable a producer to do solar. And that money would then come from the ratepayers in terms of an extra payment. The estimate that in last year's discussions by the Department of Energy is they thought that rate would be somewhere in the neighborhood of 35 to 40 cents a kilowatt hour. Put that in contrast, that's for most of the power we have now, it's less than 9 cents a kilowatt hour. Some of the wind that we're just getting in is in the 5 to 6 cent range. So we're trying to test that, and hopefully at the end of the day we will know more about how solar fits into the grid, what its economic value is as well as its cost, and what it takes in the way of a subsidy at current technology to make that work, so that in the future the legislature as the policymakers could make a decision about is it in the public's interest to continue to subsidize solar, and if so, which is the better way to do it, tax credits or a direct payment from the ratepayers? That's kind of the intent of that. Our concern about rolling them together is that you're loading in a commitment on doing larger projects. One, we question whether that's necessary because I think as Honeywell and others have demonstrated, there seems to be a way to do some of those. And you're making a commitment at a very expensive resource given today's technology without the benefit of clearly understanding its economic ramifications.
Thank you.
Are there other questions? Seeing none. I'd be interested if the committee is agreeable in adopting the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2121 so that we can keep that keep the momentum up on that, get it the fiscal and revenue prepared, and come back so that we can evaluate the Dash 4 amendments to 3039. Is there any objection to that? Representative Bailey?
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendment to House Bill 2121.
Thank you. Representative Bailey moves the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2121. They're dated April 15th. Is there any discussion? Representative Gilliam?
Mr. Chair, just the standard that I'm happy to give a courtesy vote has nothing to do with what we think about the final bill.
Understood. That's fine. Thank you, Representative Gilliam. And the same goes for Representative Bentz, I see. President Thatcher.
Yeah, and I would like to add to that that I think it's important to get the amendments in just so everybody can see exactly what we're talking about.
Indeed, that's certainly my intent. Thank you very much. Without any further comment, is there any objection to adopting the Dash 2 amendments? Seeing none, Dash 2 amendments are adopted. We will await the Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 3039 and hopefully be back for further discussion. That closed the work session on House Bill 3039 and the work session on House Bill 2121, and open a work session on House Bill 2531. Barbara, could you give us a summary to remind us, and Peden, please come forward.
HB 2531 expands the purpose of the Major League Stadium Grant Fund to include the financing, developing, constructing, and furnishing of a Major League Stadium designed for use by a Major League soccer team.
If you recall, committee, we uncovered a little bit of a glitch in our last hearing. Mr. Peden, you're back to give us an update.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Greg Peden here representing the Portland Timbers. As we discussed last Tuesday, a small issue arose on the language in the bill relating to the salaries of spouses of players. We've got amendments coming out that will do two things. One, it will make a separation here, likely to require the players to file a separate schedule of salaries and income so that we have that capturing the income off the player salaries, but not off the any salaries or income that spouses or anybody not related to the operations of the soccer team and also that it would be done such a way that it would be a minimal or zero fiscal impact to the Department of Revenue, so that there's no added cost to the state to adjust that. Hopefully we'll be back here with final amendments for your consideration on Tuesday.
Very good. Any questions? Seeing none, appreciate the update. Looking forward to seeing you back. Close the work session on House Bill 2531. And I think, are we ready for the show everyone's been waiting for? We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2015. Barbara, if you could please give us a summary.
HB 2015 establishes certain requirements before an applicant seeking to construct a liquefied natural gas terminal or related pipeline may be issued specified permits and authorizations.
Thank you very much. Opening comments. We have some time. I suspect we will not have enough time to hear everything from everyone who wants to say something. But I want to be clear that we'll do our best to do that. We have some people who we're going to call up in an attempt to be a balanced opponent sort of sequence, so that we can hear a variety of perspectives. And with that, I'm going to start by asking Jazz Adams to come forward. I'm also kind of scanning the room to see if there are any other legislators. Here's Representative Riley and Representative Boone right on cue. If you'd like to come right forward and get us started. Perhaps Representative Riley and Representative Boone, you might like to start by introducing the bill and your interest in it, and then we could hear an overview on the current situation from Mr. Adams. Would that be agreeable? Very good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Representative Chuck Riley, representing Hillsborough, Cornelius, and Forest Grove. I'm not going to spend much of your time. I know there are a whole lot of folks who want to testify on this on both sides of the issue, and I don't want to take the time that you need to do that. So I'm just going to say, I hope you will, hear this bill. I thank you for hearing the bill, and that we can get a good hearing and see where it goes. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Riley. Representative Boone?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I brought my short version of testimony today. I, too, will be brief. Got into this a while ago and joined several of my fellow colleagues in this effort. And as you all know, I'm trying to promote a different kind of energy for our state to follow. So we also did not want to create anything that was going to do any harm in that sense. And so what we are trying to do is make this so that our state has a better voice in siting facilities such as this particular form of energy. And it's gone a long way. I have toured one of the proposed pipeline routes and met a lot of new constituents of mine in my district, and have enjoyed these relationships over the past several months as this has moved forward. And also, it's the first time I've joined my colleague, Representative Riley, on a bill that our contiguous districts
share. Mr.
Chair.
I recognize the face.
I was just going to say, I'm reminded that we all are familiar with her, but perhaps you could introduce yourself.
And I'm the queen of state your name. For the record, Deborah Boone, House District 32.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rep. Gilliam, ever vigilant friend of mine. So with that, I will turn this over to others. You have a long day ahead of you. I'm sure you're going to hear all kinds of testimony. And if you are interested, I'd be happy to read from my book and answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Boone. I think that's a good suggestion, given that you both have busy schedules as well. We can take some questions for you if there are any, and then give you the opportunity to excuse yourselves if you need to. I don't see any. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Adams.
Chair Reed, distinguished members of this committee, my name is Jazz Adams. I'm the attorney in charge of the Natural Resource Section and General Counsel of the Department of Justice. I'm privileged to serve in that capacity because the collective expertise of the attorneys in the section allows us to provide legal advice to the Oregon agencies that have responsibility for natural resources and the environment. And I'm here today to comment, to highlight Sections 1 and Section 2 of the -3 amendments to House Bill 2015, to comment on preemption risk, and also to give you a brief update on the status of current legal proceedings involving LNG in Oregon. So in a nutshell, House Bill 2015 with these dash three amendments requires in Section 1 that two prerequisites be met for Oregon's proprietary authorizations for use of the state's land and water. And in Section 2, in a nutshell, this bill would impose a standard of no adverse effect on beneficial uses of water for Oregon's determinations that are made under the Federal Clean Water Act. In Section 1, just to highlight that, the two prerequisites are, first, the Department of Energy must make a number of findings, and you can see them listed out in Section 1, a finding that there is a significant need for natural gas in Oregon that LNG will meet, and these are findings that must be made before an applicant applies for or is issued a permit or any other form of authorization to use state-owned land or water for an LNG facility. Other findings, the second finding must be that there are inadequate supplies of domestic natural gas, and by that I mean North American gas. Three, that the price of liquefied natural gas will not exceed the price of domestic gas. And four, that operation of the LNG terminal will be consistent with Oregon's strategies for addressing climate change. And the other prerequisite besides those findings by the Department of Energy would be a prior cost agreement such that the LNG or the related pipeline developer must first have a signed agreement committing to cover the state's costs of reviewing all permit certification authorization applications related to the LNG facility. The, Section 2 imposes a no significant effect standard in relation to the state's exercise of its responsibilities under the Clean Water Act. And under the Dash 3 amendments, it makes this much clearer than before, that in exercising its delegated authority under the Clean Water Act, the state cannot permit or otherwise authorize any LNG terminal or pipeline that adversely affects beneficial uses of Oregon rivers and other waters. And hence, but for this legislation, those two proprietary prerequisites and the Clean Water Act no adverse effect standard would not be in place. So this legislation provides for the consistent exercise of Oregon's proprietary authority and its federally delegated authority in relation to LNG facilities. Let me turn to preemption risk, because I know that has been a concern in some. DOJ has reviewed House Bill 2015 and the Dash 3 amendments, and we believe that the legislation with those amendments would withstand a preemption challenge, because on its face, this bill involves Oregon's proprietary authority and Oregon's exercise of its federally delegated authority under the Clean Water Act. Turning to the proprietary interest, a main focus of this bill in Section 1, as I've mentioned, is to establish those two prerequisites, but they're prerequisites for the use of Oregon-owned waters and Oregon-owned lands. Use of state-owned water and land is a function of Oregon's proprietary interest, that is, interest in its own property, property that the state of Oregon itself owns. And the changes that Congress made in 2005 to the Natural Gas Act may have limited states' regulatory authority over siting of LNG terminals and pipelines, but it did not limit the state's proprietary authority over its own property. And as the U.S. Supreme Court has commented in 1993, a state may act without offending preemption principles when it acts as a proprietor, not as a regulator. And I would also note that this 2005 federal legislation did not provide the right to take property through eminent domain for the LNG terminals themselves. And hence, Congress preserved the state's right, their proprietary rights, to determine how and whether to allow the use of state-owned land and water for an LNG import terminal facility. And this is no different than the right of any landowner to set the terms and conditions under which it would allow an LNG developer to use its property absent eminent domain. So in sum, these two proprietary prerequisites in Section 1, that's the OD, the Department of Energy findings and the prior cost agreements, apply only when an LNG terminal developer is asking to use state-owned land and state-owned water, and hence we think that that is would withstand a preemption challenge. Secondly, Section 2 provides that no adverse impact standard in the state's exercise of its responsibilities under the Clean Water Act. The 2005 amendments to the Natural Gas Act specifically allowed states to implement the Federal Clean Water Act, and so therefore the establishment of a protective standard for waters within Oregon is not preempted, and specifically the so-called savings clause in the 2005 legislation from Congress provided, quote, nothing in this act affects the rights of states under, end quote, and then it lists the Clean Water Act. So in sum, although one could not rule out the filing of litigation challenging this legislation on preemption grounds, DOJ would vigorously defend the legislation against such a challenge, and we believe that Section 1 of the Dash 3 amendments is within Oregon's proprietary authority, and Section 2 is within Oregon's federally delegated authority under the Clean Water Act. And thirdly, I would like to comment at the request of Chair Reed on the status of current legal proceedings involving LNG. I would note that given the multiple projects and numerous state agencies involved in these projects, I cannot give you a detailed report, nor even if I could, it would take up all the time today. And because also I would note there are a number of complex legal issues associated to these cases. We have an active appeal in one case and a number of other proceedings pending. I really can't go into a number of legal issues that would be inappropriate to discuss. But what I can tell you is the current status. And there are three, as you I'm sure know, three LNG terminal projects planned for Oregon. The one that's furthest along is the Bradwood Import Terminal Facility. It was first approved by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission on September 18, 2008, and then a request for a hearing from Oregon was denied on January 15, 2009. The state of Oregon, through various agencies, has petitioned for judicial review in the Ninth Circuit of FERC's issuance of a license for the Bradwood facility. And among other issues that Oregon at least has identified as potentially being argued on the appeal, they include FERC's issuance of a conditional license, the so-called conditional license issue, the Endangered Species Act, basically a failure to commence consultation before the license was issued, the National Environmental Policy Act, that is to say the adequacy of the environmental impact statements, improper delegation by FERC to its Office of Energy Projects, and FERC's failure to determine the need in Oregon for an LNG facility. And in relation to this litigation, Oregon has requested from FERC a stay of the proceedings pending appeal so as to prevent any construction or eminent domain activities from going forward until the Ninth Circuit has a chance to rule. The Ninth Circuit, in turn, has held this matter in abeyance until May 11th to allow FERC to rule. And there's a briefing schedule in place. The state's brief under the current schedule would be due on July 6th. I would also note that other entities such as the state of Washington and NOAA Fisheries have also petitioned for judicial review in the Ninth Circuit. The second LNG terminal facility is Jordan Cove in Coos Bay. The Department of Energy intervened before FERC. The draft environmental impact statement has issued. The state of Oregon commented on it. The final EAS is expected. Environmental impact statement is expected very soon. And this terminal facility has a 200-plus mile related pipeline. The third LNG facility is Oregon LNG in Warrenton. Seven state agencies have intervened before FERC. It's before the draft environmental impact statement has issued. And this proposal also has a 200-plus mile related pipeline. And there are at least three pipeline projects planned for Oregon. The Palomar Pipeline, it connects near Bradwood to eastern Oregon near Madras. And the same seven Oregon agencies have intervened before FERC, but again, it's before any draft environmental impact statement. The Ruby Pipeline extends from the Rockies to Oregon. The same agencies from Oregon have intervened before FERC. Again, it's before a draft environmental impact statement is issued. And finally, the last pipeline is the Sunstone Pipeline, again from the Rockies to Oregon. And as I understand it, it's not yet before the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and there's been no interventions before FERC. That concludes my prepared comments. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Very helpful to understand the background. Are there any questions? Representative Witt?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm curious, Jazz, if you have any sense of how open the Section 1, Sub 1, Sub C, the price of natural gas versus liquefied gas, whether this would be open to challenge in an international trade court, and if so, what the anticipated cost for the state of Oregon to defend against that.
And may I add on to that question? When I read it, I noticed it says will not exceed the price of natural gas. I have kind of a more basic question for how long?
So maybe you could come.
Chair Reed, Representative Witt, I think that what this requirement simply requires that there be a study and a finding by the Department of Energy before a permit could be granted. Don't think I can answer that question. I could get back to the committee if it so desires as to whether this would be an issue that might arise in an international trade court. But I think on its face, it simply requires a finding by an Oregon state agency that's a kind of a price determination, which is well within, if this legislation were passed, well within the authority of the legislature and of the agency to do.
Thank you. Did you have a follow-up?
No, I would like to know what the likely cost of that would be.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions? Representative Benz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The language on page 2 of dash 3, lines 14 and 15, the adversely affect standard. Can you share with us your thoughts on what that means?
Well, I think what this means is that before it would be primarily the Department of Environmental Quality would issue a 401 certification or a 402 and National Pollution Discharge permit would actually have to make a finding, and this is language that's basically established under the Clean Water Act, a finding that there would be no adverse impact on designated beneficial uses of the water. And there's a number of them that are potential, but this bill highlights commercial and recreational fishing, recreation, agriculture, fish, and wildlife. So it basically what this provision of the bill requires that DEQ make a finding that there would be no adverse impact on those beneficial uses of the water.
Hello, Mr. Chair. Please.
Right. Yes, what I was looking for is the definition of adverse impact, as you understand it under the Clean Water Act, and in general, because I have a feeling we're going to hear a lot of testimony today about adverse impacts. It might be helpful to all those here to know what that standard is.
Well, the term is not defined in the bill. I'm actually would have to get back to you on what that might mean. If it is, in fact, a term of art, adverse impact in the Clean Water Act, I'd have to get back to you on that.
Sure. Please. Thank you. And it seems to me that there's a material element to that adverse impact. That's what I'm getting at. The nature of adverse impact has to be something more than a minimal impact. And that's what I was hoping you might be able to help us with, so that people would have in mind that want to testify about adverse impacts, what exactly this standard would be that the DEQ would be trying to apply to proposed activities.
I think just basically looking at the text of the statute as it's written in the Dash 3 amendments, it says adverse impact, and that would be any adverse impact.
Chair, please. Yes, that would be true. The question would be adverse impact. There's different measures of adverse impact. So what I'm trying to get at is the measure of that adversity, because there's in some people's eyes something's adverse, and others it might not be anything at all. So the question is it material adverse impact? Is it minor adverse impact? That's what I'm getting at.
Chair Reed, Representative Pence, I don't know the answer to that question. It is adverse impact is what the bill states.
Correct.
And I think it would be in DEQ's estimation as to whether there was or was not an adverse impact.
Thank you. Other questions? I don't see any. Thank you very much. Actually, I do have one question. I'm sorry, I should have jumped in earlier. Can you go through just a little bit more detail? I was taking some notes, and I think I mostly kept up on the timing you mentioned with we're waiting for the Ninth Circuit to respond. And did I hear you correctly that the challenge in the Ninth Circuit is essentially that the FERC process did not was not adequate? Is that about right?
Yes.
Okay. And could you go over those dates again for me?
Sure.
I think I got confused there.
Well, the matter has been held in abeyance till May 11 by the Ninth Circuit to allow FERC to rule on the motion for stay.
So that means nothing happens until May 11th?
Correct.
Okay.
Meanwhile, however, the record is due, the administrative record is due May 26. The Oregon's opening brief is due July 6. The respondent's brief is due August 5, and reply briefs would be due thereafter.
Okay.
Those dates are all subject to change because FERC has not yet ruled on the request for stay. And so if FERC doesn't rule, then the parties will probably go back before the Ninth Circuit and say we need another block of time.
Okay. And among the possible outcomes from the Ninth Circuit would be to agree with the state's position that FERC did not do an adequate job. But one possibility, the other is FERC did do an adequate job, project goes forward. Are there other possibilities that I'm not thinking of?
Well, if the Ninth Circuit concludes that the FERC process was inadequate in a number of the ways, or there are other violations of the ESA or NEPA, it would remand back to FERC to correct those insufficiencies, if that's the way the Ninth Circuit does. If the Ninth Circuit says, affirms FERC's order, then events unfold.
Okay. As they said, Representative Betts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Final question. The Dash 3 amendments require that the applicant agree to pay for the analysis that the bill requires. Is there any limitation on the state's ability to impose that obligation upon an applicant that you're aware of?
You mean in other sources of law?
Correct.
I'm not aware of any other source of law. I think this would be basically this legislative body could say, in exchange for the privilege of applying for a state permit, that the cost be paid up front. And one of the concerns I know on the behalf of state agencies is the cost in reviewing applications, which is tremendous. And in these tough times, that's quite challenging for the agencies.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Looking to see if there are any other legislators who have snuck in. I don't see them. So let's call Joe Desmond, please. And there, I have a number of other panels that will follow. Let me get started here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the opportunity to be here today. My name is Joseph Desmond, and I serve as Senior Vice President for External Affairs of Northern Star Natural Gas. Northern Star is the company developing the Bradwood Landing Terminal, which is located about 18 miles east of Astoria. Before I comment on the bill, I wanted to make a few brief comments on LNG, or liquefied natural gas. Liquefied natural gas is simply natural gas. It has been cooled to minus 260 degrees, where it shrinks to 1/600th of its volume in order to make transportation easier and more economical. It is non-explosive. It is not stored under pressure. As a liquid, it is not flammable. And should it ever be spilled, it would evaporate as it warms back into a gas, leaving behind no residue. Even considering the increased energy associated with liquefaction and transportation, its greenhouse gas emissions are still less than half of coal-fired power generation. The LNG industry has an impressive safety record. In fact, Northwest Natural has safely operated two LNG facilities, one in Portland since 1969 and the other in Newport since 1979, that help provide reliable gas services in times of peak energy demand. That there are three developers seeking to build a terminal is evidence enough that there is a real need and demand for additional natural gas supplies in this region. An LNG terminal would help diversify the region's supply of gas and represent a competitive supply option. A project cannot be successful unless it can secure long-term contracts for its regas services and facilities between local wholesale gas buyers and sellers willing to accept the local price for natural gas. Because of that dynamic, our companies and the projects themselves, their economic interests are aligned with those of consumers in the sense that no one benefits from higher priced gas. There's no benefit or profit associated with that. Another way of saying it is that a company, an LNG developer, can only succeed if it can bring supplies that are willing to sell at or less than the local price. No one is compelled or forced under any condition to pay more for LNG than it would for natural gas it could get either domestically or from Canada. Regarding House Bill 2015, let's be clear about what it would do. It would create an effective ban on LNG and related natural gas infrastructure at a time when Oregon is using more natural gas to generate electricity. It needs natural gas-fired power to firm up renewable sources of energy, and its existing supplies of natural gas are being constrained in different parts due to competition from new states. House Bill 2015 provides no solutions for Oregon's growing and well-documented need for additional supplies of natural gas. The constraints on Oregon supplies have been documented by the Oregon Department of Energy, by the Public Utility Commission, even in a letter from Chairman Beyer to the governor, and by Oregon's gas utilities in testimony that they file regularly with the Public Utility Commission. Today, Oregon imports 100% of the natural gas it consumes. Two-thirds of that gas comes from Canada, technically speaking a foreign country, and Canada is using more of its gas domestically to produce petroleum in the tar sands. Canadian conventional gas well production is also declining. The other third comes from the U.S. Rocky Mountain states. Rockies producers have recently built new pipelines that will carry Rockies gas east to higher-priced U.S. markets, which means that the Pacific Northwest will find itself competing for those traditional sources of supply. HB 2015 is unnecessary. I say that because Oregon's authority over LNG-related permits already exists. Existing law provides Oregon significant authority to issue or deny LNG-related permits through the state's administration of the Federal Clean Air, Clean Water, and Coastal Zone Management Acts. Oregon is a standards-based permit-compliance state, which with clearly defined requirements to ensure that permit decisions are not arbitrary or capricious. Recent decisions by the U.S. Supreme Court have also affirmed that LNG projects cannot proceed until the projects have secured all necessary state permits. In other words, no project can break ground until it has satisfied the state's requirements. Previous attempts by other coastal states to ban LNG through similar, what I'll call backdoor modification as seen in this bill, of state standards have all been struck down by the courts. Maryland's attempt was denied by the U.S. Court of Appeals in the Fourth Circuit, and Delaware's was recently struck down by the D.C. Circuit.
Mr. Desmond, may I ask you, I notice you're following your written testimony well, and we have that. We'll certainly read it. I'm hoping you might be able to summarize so we have a chance to ask you questions.
I'd be happy to. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Essentially, this new need determination has already been considered and rejected by Oregon's Energy Facility Siting Council in a June decision of 2005. I have a copy of that here. It's also true that Oregon itself has a statute that says for new power generating facilities, there is no needs requirement in order to determine. It looks to the marketplace in order to determine what, in fact, should be built. The challenge that you have here is that a project moving forward is energy systems are highly complex, they're dynamic, and at best the needs determination represents only a snapshot in time. The problem that you face is, having made that determination, neither the ODOE or the PUC has the authority to compel a utility to move forward with the construction of necessary infrastructure, even if it did conclude it was needed. So while there are other problems with the bill, we want to summarize that it conflicts with some of the existing state law. It conflicts with previous findings of the Energy Facilities Siting Council. We believe it to be unnecessary and somewhat redundant since the state already has significant authority. And if passed, it would arbitrarily limit Oregon's options in its supply of natural gas, which we don't believe is in the interest of customers or businesses. Instead, clean-burning natural gas represents a viable option to help meet growing energy needs.
Thanks, Mr. Desmond.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Questions, please.
For the committee, Representative Betts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You indicated the a bill of this nature would be struck down or by the courts. What part of it would be struck down? What part of it? Just pick if there's more than
sure,
one, the most likely.
There are several instances. For instance, goods in interstate commerce. Federal law preempts state regulation of LNG and interstate and foreign commerce by means of state laws. And there's some sites, and we can provide this information to you. Secondarily, state regulation of the use and storage of imported LNG at a terminal is also preempted by the Natural Gas Act. And thirdly, there is some preemption under the Pipeline Safety Act. So there's a lot of statutes that are out there. Essentially, the courts have ruled.
Just quickly, we heard from, I think, the Attorney General's office earlier that portions of this bill would not be susceptible to being struck down.
Mm-hmm.
Did you agree with that?
Not at all.
And why is that?
Well, based on our review of case law and the previous cases that have been similarly tried. In fact, Delaware, about 3 weeks ago, struck down a similar challenge by the state against another project in which it found, under similar circumstances, that FERC had acted, even though it acted with conditions, because it concluded at the end of the day, no project can proceed until it satisfies all local, state, and federal requirements, including compliance under the Endangered Species Act, and because there can be no action, therefore there can be no harm until that process is complete.
I think the Attorney General was focusing on the Clean Water Act and the state's authority under it. Why would you challenge that opinion?
Well, I'd have to have my attorneys give you more of a detail, but similar attempts were made in the state of Maryland associated with modifying the state's interpretation of new criteria that were applied under the Clean Water Act. And essentially, it would have required that they first sought approval from the federal government before they could implement that. So it has to do with that. But again, I can provide the citations in that detail for you.
Thank you.
Representative Witt?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Desmond, you mentioned emissions, and I was wondering on a spectrum of the carbon emissions where LNG would lie in terms of those emissions?
Sure. There are, I guess, two parts I could answer to that. One is that all the projects have to comply already today with the state's greenhouse gas emissions requirements. If you were to consider for a moment the life cycle cost, which is the energy associated with the liquefaction and then the transport of that gas across the sea, you would see somewhere between 20% and 30% more greenhouse gas emissions. But that, even considering that higher amount, it is still less than half of the life cycle emissions of coal. And it would be worth noting that other countries have rules that account for and then are required to comply with those upstream emissions. So, yes, you can count them, but you can't sort of double count or penalize. From the perspective of what's the emissions of the terminal, the actual emissions are calculated to be less than one-half of 1% of Oregon's annual greenhouse gas emissions associated with the operation of a terminal.
Thank you. Are there other questions? Representative Bailey?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Desmond, can you just help clarify for me? So you represent the company that is involved in the construction of Bradwood Landing?
That is correct.
And how many other proposals are there? I'm sorry, follow up.
There are three other proposals in Oregon.
Okay. And is it correct that that's the Bradwood one at Warrenton and Jordan Cove?
No, Bradwood is east of Astoria at Bradwood itself,
okay.
Bradwood Landing at Bradwood. There is Oregon LNG, which is located in Warrenton, and there's the Jordan Cove project, which is located in Coos Bay.
So a total of three.
Total of three projects, that's correct.
Total of three. Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Please.
And how long do these projects take to construct?
Sure, approximately 3 to 4 years.
3 to 4 years.
3 to 4 years of construction. Go ahead.
And to, if, for example, they were at some point in the future to become obsolete, how long to deconstruct?
I don't have the exact time frame. However, we are required, in fact, it was imposed by Clatsop County under their Lux approval that we have money set aside in the decommissioning fee. But the actual amount of labor hours associated with the construction is approximately 2 million labor hours during its construction over that 3 to 4 year period.
You may not, this may be a question for somebody else, given that you only represent one of the terminals. How many terminals, well, first of all, do these terminals serve more than the immediate area around the terminal?
Well, when we define immediate area, it depends on the project. Our project is focused on serving primarily the needs of the Pacific Northwest. And we went through the exercise of having to demonstrate both at FERC and at the county that we could serve and operate that project independently, meaning without any additional pipelines that could move gas elsewhere. Other projects have different proposals to connect to the interstate gas systems, but by and large, the gas is generally used and consumed where it's delivered, and then you're able to display gas that comes from other areas. The reason that that is important is when a utility is buying natural gas, it is having to pay for the transportation cost of moving it from point A to point B. In the case of the Rockies, that is 700 to 800 miles of transportation costs. What Northwest Natural has concluded in running some of their simulations is that the ability to access natural gas along the Columbia would save their consumers in transportation costs alone somewhere on the order of $500 million on a present value basis over the next 20 years. That is setting aside any expected savings or downward price pressure from having additional supplies available.
So it sounds like then the area of service is, at least in your market analysis, is the Pacific Northwest.
That is the primary. That's correct.
Okay. How do we make a determination about how many terminals we need? If we have three terminals and each of them serves, I would assume, the Pacific Northwest area, is there coordination between your companies on how many terminals are needed or why three different terminals are needed?
There's no coordination. We are competitive alternatives to each other to a large degree. The market itself, much like power generating facilities that are constructed, you're required to go out and to secure debt financing. The debt financing has to be, stand behind with contracts. Those contracts require confidence that the consumption of the ability of the buyer to take it. So our role is to match buyers and sellers and to be able to demonstrate that to secure the financing to complete the construction. Once those needs are met within the marketplace, there isn't always necessarily the same amount of need required that would justify financing a second terminal, which is why you don't see extra transmission lines or extra power plants that normally sit idle. Capital markets are very efficient, and so in that sense, you would see one, maybe two, but generally one particular project. Again, depending on what its primary target market is there to serve.
Thank you. Quickly, please. I'll keep it moving. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate the indulgence. So given that there's clearly a larger public good aspect and externality at each of these terminals, and as I believe I heard you say that it's difficult to make a need determination, and there isn't sufficient coordination between your companies to coordinate on the start of those investments, and that they have a long time to decommission if they are built and become obsolete. At what point is there a public role to be able to step in from a larger perspective and make a determination about whether or not there is a coordinated need between separate facilities?
Again, I'm not so sure that there is that public role. The role of the agencies here is to ensure compliance with applicable safety standards and the environmental standards. Ultimately, if there is not sufficient demand for the gas, those projects will not be built, and so they essentially will go through a process. They will reimburse the agencies as we have. We have gone now through this process nearly 5 years, 42 months before FERC, 50,000 pages of testimony, nearly $50 million in studies and permitting costs. It's very significant, and it's not undertaken lightly from the investment community. But you would not see that interest unless there was confidence that the long-term demand for natural gas is there. And it's there because that you're not building new coal plants, you're not building new hydro plants. Resources such as wind and solar are important, but they are intermittent resources, and they have to be firmed up. And that the move to reducing emissions is placing increasing demand on natural gas and supplies of natural gas.
Thank you. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Joe, can you briefly hit the highlights of the various hoops that you have to jump through in the permitting process, and what level of public involvement is attached to each one of those hoops?
Sure. I'll break them into three categories. We have local requirements that are done at the county level. We have state requirements, and then we have federal requirements. At the local level, we have to go through the land use compatibility statement process. That involves testimony before the Planning Commission, testimony before the full commission. There are hearings, public hearings, testimony, rebuttal testimony, and ultimately a record is established, and then that record is repeated when it goes to the county again. At the federal level, we're looking at compliance with cultural and archaeological resources, wetlands. We have to comply with the U.S. Coast Guard safety, security zone requirements for vehicle or vessel traffic. Under the Endangered Species Act, there is compliance requirements through the consultation with the National Marine Fisheries Agency to render a biological opinion. And at the state, we have to get permits from DEQ, DFW, DLCD, DOT, DSL, OWRD, in other words, numerous water, air, and hundreds of other smaller permits through that process. Virtually all of that require public notice, documentation that is submitted and reviewed. You know, and so we work with the agencies, and we have said on numerous occasions, as have the other projects, that they cannot proceed until they have satisfied all applicable local, state, and federal regulations. And that is true, and that doesn't bear or expect a particular outcome out of that process.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, may I ask one more technical question?
Very quickly, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just very quickly, so I understand the nature of the facilities. Are these purely facilities? Do they have a heating reconstituting function? Is there also a cooling function at that?
No. The proposal that we have is for a regasification terminal only, which means we're able to accept liquefied natural gas, store it, and then export it. The two Northwest Natural peaking facilities actually do both. They do the liquefaction and they do the regasification, but they do it on a smaller scale. In this instance, though, the projects themselves, there are a number of reasons, and I know the question has been asked, can you export natural gas? And the answer is no, because, number one, the site, the topography does not lend itself. You need significantly more land to do the regas than we would otherwise. The acreage isn't there. Financially, the model, it costs 10 times more to liquefy, and it makes no economic sense to take, there's no gas resources here. So the model doesn't work that way. Regulatory, our permits are only for import, and they're not for anything else. And technologically, you don't have the technology that would allow you to even do it offshore or come up with something else.
I just want to note for the benefit of the audience, I've been trying to wrap up questions for Mr. Desmond. There's one more. Yep. Representative Metz.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And this question is a broad question, and it has to do with there is no doubt that the state of Oregon and the folks that are here today are going to be adversely impacted by these activities. My question is, I would like a number, which probably is impossible for you to give us, about the greater good. That is, how is the rest of the state of Oregon going to benefit from your activities? Is there a measure you can put on it for us?
Sure. There's a number of ways that you could look at that. From an economic perspective, we have local direct benefits. In our case, it's nearly $8 million a year in property taxes to Clatsop County, which is more than 100% increase over the current base that they have. There are the ongoing jobs, about 65 permanent, 2 million construction labor hours, so you have that. We would be expending approximately $30 million per year back into the economy during operations and maintenance. Economically, the reason that you have to consider access to affordable gas supplies is Oregon competes on a global level. Historically, it has benefited from access to low-cost hydropower, but that's no longer a possibility. So ensuring adequate supplies is important because it places Oregon businesses, it creates an advantage for them. Conversely, higher prices would put them at a disadvantage. So it's about not just the job creation, but the job retention. Environmentally, I would tell you that we have proposed a project that is designed to provide a net environmental benefit, which means above and beyond all of the mitigation and offsets that we do, there's a voluntary component that is designed to return a significantly greater environmental benefit. And again, we have to prove that and go through the consultation process, but those are the benefits. In the same way, where the gas goes, you know, Oregon benefits from power that's generated else out of the state, even in its petroleum. And so looking at the notion of need only from a very narrow perspective is difficult because it doesn't capture how the system actually operates and is designed to work.
Thank you.
Thank you. I want to start on our list with the folks who have traveled more than 100 miles to be with us. That's John Donzer. Can't tell if that's a U or an O in the second letter. Pete starts with an H, I think. And Ken
Leahy,
perhaps. As you're coming up, next, I'll mention who's going to be on deck. Those folks may be on the way from another room. Do we have E.M. Easterly? No E.M. Easterly. How about Cheryl Johnson or Bill McCaffrey? Please come forward. I'm trying to get those folks who have traveled a long way, but you could get started officially. So in order to try to get a lot of people in, I'm going to ask if you could keep your testimony to 3 minutes, please, and I'll start when you do. Go ahead. Whoever would like to go first.
Chairman Reed, members of the committee, my name is Cheryl Johnson, and I'm a retired school librarian from Astoria in Clatsop County. I'm here today with other community members who are affected by the three LNG proposed projects for our state. We are some of the 300 citizens who requested this legislation. We strongly support HB 2015 and urge you to support this bill as well. HB 2015 is a common-sense business decision and is consistent with the governor's energy policies. HB 2015 would require that, before committing state resources, the state conduct an evaluation on the need for LNG. This bill does not ban LNG. It does strengthen and clarify the state's authority over these points. I am joined today by many, many community members who came great distances to attend this hearing and who would testify except for the time constraint on this hearing. I would like to ask that those in the room who support 2015 quietly raise your hands at this time. And there are many, many more out in the hall who couldn't fit in today. We do not believe that there is a need for LNG in our state, so why would we put in jeopardy our natural resources that are the foundation of the fishing and tourism industries that support and that support the economic communities and are the supportive communities like mine in Astoria? Why would we put in jeopardy the farms, orchards, and vineyards that are stable local industries supporting so many Oregon working families? We encourage the committee to follow the legal advice of the DOJ and not Mr. Desmond's contrary interpretation. We strongly encourage all of you to support this common sense bill, which simply requires the state to prove a need before committing the resources that belong to the people of this state of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to go first. Okay. Next, I should say.
Yeah. Representative Reed and members of the committee. My name is Bill McCaffrey. I'm a resident of North Bend, Oregon, in Coos County, a lifetime resident there on the South Coast. I'm also a native of North Bend. I am also a 35-year member of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 932 from Coos Bay, Oregon, and I am currently a union electrical contractor in North Bend. I also have 18 years' experience in the instrumentation field. I've also attended the Instrument Society of America's Technical School in Raleigh, North Carolina. With my background in industrial, electrical, and instrumentation, I have the experience and skills to manage an electrical and instrumentation department of an LNG facility such as the one that's being proposed across the bay from North Bend's Southwest Regional Airport. However, the very few permanent jobs that would be created and the ever-present danger that would exist from the chance of a catastrophic mishap is not worth the effort, especially when there's no need for the gas. And that is from the Oregon Department of Energy's May 2008 findings. The jobs in tourism, recreation, timber, and the renewable industry are all at risk if these LNG proposals go forward. The scientific reports are clear on this, and these terminals will compete with renewable energy. Is it not Oregon's goal to have 25% renewable energy by 2025? I say we look forward to the future and use our resources wisely. We need to be proactive in securing permanent manufacturing jobs in the green renewable energy. Salem, Millersburg, Hillsboro, and Portland are already on track with solar and wind manufacturing. In the April 2009 IBEW electrical worker, they say that Salem is ready to man up the $80 million Sanyo solar plant here in southwest Salem. They also have an article on the new green energy grid that will should be built to handle all the green energy in the nation. There's 30,000 megawatts of solar power in California that can't even go on the grid. There's also, it says, 40,000 megawatts of wind power from the Great Lakes area that can't go on the grid. It will take 75,000 new jobs to build a smart grid to handle this power.
We're just coming up on 3 minutes, too. So
okay.
If you could just wrap up, that'd be
anyway, great. In conclusion, all we're asking is that the LNG companies follow the National Environmental Policy Act and prove the need first before they destroy existing jobs in the green energy sector and our environment. I support House Bill 2626 for energy efficiency and House Bill 2015, the LNG Public Protections Act. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. McCaffrey. I hope there's some women at the Sanyo plant, too.
Yeah.
I heard you say man up.
Chairman Reed, members of the committee, E.M. Easterly. I'm a local fellow who...
You're local?
Yes,
you traveled
I am.
More than 100.
I was surprised when you... Did I mischeck it? I apologize.
You checked that you traveled more than 100 miles. That's
I
what
apologize.
Brought you to the front of the line here.
I will leave.
No, no, it's fine. It's fine. Go ahead. Go ahead.
I was aghast because I didn't know what the lines were. I live with gas lines in the street. We in this building have gas lines all around us. Sometime in the next 50 years, we're going to need gas. The question is, how are we as a state going to make a decision in terms of when that there's an economic sense to it? The federal government sets up and tells us under a long history of utilities and transmissions how the rules get played. I don't want to dispute the experts, but I do ask you and your fellow members of the legislature to make sure that the kind of values that Oregon expects and anticipates in the kinds of things that you're going to hear in testimony today are carefully considered. I'm willing to take the challenge and the possibility that this nicely drafted ordinance, it isn't the most perfect one, but it's certainly one I ask you to say yes to let the process continue. Folks who want to make money, I give them all the credit in the world. I hate government representation of the kind that tells me what to do. But sometimes the little guy who is represented by you has to have the feeling that maybe local government has a role to play, and in this case, I truly think that this ordinance gives the state a true opportunity to raise the kinds of issues that are being raised here.
Thank you very much. If there aren't any burning questions from the panel, I think we'll keep it going and try to get as many folks in as we can. Hopefully the other folks read the 100-mile line, right?
So I'll ask. My deep apologies.
No worries. John Dunzer, Pete, please. For Pete, again, the H and the rest of the handwriting I can't read, and Ken Leahy. Did any of them make it in?
Is there someone I can turn in?
Yes. The committee assistant can help you.
Sorry, I didn't know about 25 copies.
No problem. Commissioner Bob Austin from Clackamas County, and Senator Walker has just joined us. Come on up, please. Your timing is excellent. There's an empty seat. Go ahead, sir. Please.
John Dunzer, Seaside, Oregon. I've got 35 years' experience in this particular field. I've worked for the Department of Energy both as a contractor and as an employee. I've built some of these LNG facilities before. I'm very much supportive of this facility. I'm very much against this particular bill. And the reason that I'm against this bill is because it's not inclusive enough. We definitely need the LNG, not only for the reasons that the wonderful Energy Department has told you that you don't need them, but what you need it for is a hydrogen program that's coming along, which absolutely has to have natural gas. And you need LNG to replace the coal that's there, because you've got a 40-year window before you can substitute some of these alternative energies. And I've just come back from Europe, where they've been working on it for 25 years, and they're up to 24% alternative energy. We're going to need LNG. We're going to need to have some supplies of natural gas in this particular area. Now, that being said, it's a good site. I like it better than the other two. Who cares? The problem is that this Bradford facility is an abomination in terms of its design. It's 30 years behind the times. I agree with almost everything that Mr. Desmond said, except that this facility is adequately regulated by the state of Oregon and its permit system. It is not. The area of energy, this is a big heater. When you look at big heaters, You got to look at using alternative energy for that heat. You got to look at using cogeneration, which was thought of at one time but then rejected. You've got to think in terms of these types of issues. You got to think in terms of using the cooling that comes off that LNG as a refrigerant and generating industrial gases for your solar power industry. You got to think about jobs, because if you put in a better design for this gasification system, one that'll make money for everybody, it'll also create twice the number of jobs. And we desperately need the jobs, and we need to look at jobs. Mr. Witt, I don't understand. I've talked to Cy Garrett, I've talked to all these people. Each of these three facilities has a different gasification system designed. Bradwood's the worst. Coos Bay is probably the best because it uses a combustion. They use a power plant there, and they use the exhaust from the power plant to partially heat up this gas.
Ms. Denzer, we're coming up on 3 minutes, so if you could wrap up, please.
The technology is here. The Chinese are building these facilities. They're using this technology. What's going on here? We're supposed to be the technology leaders. We're not doing anything right here. We need to use our technology, and we need to stop worrying about 4 and 5 years and lawyers and people that don't know what LNG is. We need to do these. We need to do something right.
Thank you, Mr. Denzer. I appreciate your passion for thinking long term. Senator Walker?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7. It's a pleasure to appear for the first time in front of your committee.
Thank you.
I'm here in support of House Bill 2015, and particularly I want to speak to the -1 amendment. And this amendment has been brought about at my request. And have you not seen it?
We have the -3s. I don't know that we have -1s in front of us, do we?
Okay. Then maybe the -1s have been morphed into the -3. And I haven't been alerted to that. So I'll speak to the -3 without knowing all of what's in there. But the -1 was brought about at my request. And let me tell you how that's come about. I co-chair the Natural Resources Subcommittee, which has control over all of the natural resources budgets. As we began reviewing the budgets, and we're hearing about 30% cuts now, but in the beginning we heard about the rebalance that we had to do, I began to ask state agencies how much money they had spent reviewing LNG applications in the state of Oregon. As you know, that process is controlled by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And the state of Oregon, at the governor's request, the state was asked to review all LNG applications in terms of how they will impact the state. These are things the governor asked these agencies to do. These are things the agencies are charged with doing. But I have to tell you that as I began reviewing the budgets, we, the taxpayers of the state of Oregon, are the ones on the hook for reviewing an application by a private developer to site LNG in Oregon. And I'm, frankly, not in favor of my taxpayer dollars or anyone else's going to pay to review someone's application. So I asked the Department of Justice if they could come up with some language that would get us there where we need to go to make sure we assess these charges to the applicants. Let me give you an example of how much money the state of Oregon is so far on the hook for, and you will understand why my ire is intense, though I don't think I will rise to the level as my neighbor, though I appreciate his passion. The Department of Energy has thus far spent $250,000. This includes just processing of applications, and it's probably a conservative estimate because there were other monies spent on studies, and they haven't had enough time to answer the question fully. The Department of Environmental Quality has spent $175,000 to date. They have been reimbursed for some work, but this also is probably a conservative estimate because they ballpark the Department of Justice costs when they have to pay DOJ attorneys. The Department of State Lands, who was just in front of my committee testifying, and I gave them a little note, they've spent about $126,000 to date, but the bulk of their work is yet to come. Additionally, here's the big whopper.
We have another here's the whopper, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. I knew I'd seen a $1 million figure in one of the answers to my question. They anticipate if all seven projects complete the FERC permitting process, ODF&W will have expended approximately $1 million. Currently, they've spent 3,400 hours, and they estimate that cost to be in the range of $150,000. Finally, the Oregon Water Resources Department, and I don't have numbers for the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, but the Water Resources Department has spent $16,169 to date. I will tell you that agency, of all these agencies, cannot afford to spend any general fund money because their agency is 70% general fund, and we are struggling to keep that agency alive in my subcommittee right now. So this amendment, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, is very appropriate for the taxpayers of the state of Oregon to make these applicants pay for all of these costs that our agencies are charged with. And I would seriously urge you to consider this amendment to be included in the bill today so that we can see cost recovery for Oregonians.
Thank you, Senator Walker. I know you came from another committee, so let me ask our committee if we have any questions for you, and then you can excuse yourself
and
back to your other obligations. Representative Gilley?
Mr. Chair, this may not be for the Senator, but are we saying that I don't see it? Is it in three, or we're getting one?
My understanding is that the Senator initiated dash one, which then was subsumed by dash three, so that the dash three reflects the things she was talking about. At least that's certainly my reading.
Somebody point out to me where we are, then, on three?
Sure.
Cost recovery.
I believe that's on page 1, line 9. The applicant must enter into a written agreement in which the applicant agrees to compensate the state for all costs associated with the review and evaluation of any permit, authorization, or certification related to liquefied natural gas terminal and pipelines directly related to the terminal. Is that it?
And Mr. Chair and Representative Gillum, that's exactly the language I'm talking about. Thank you very much.
Please.
Senator, then you have a lot of experience in evaluating these budgets, so is this... Are there precedents for this type of request for compensation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gillum, let me see if I understand your question. You mean, is there a precedent for what I'm asking for in this amendment?
Correct.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Gillum, this is the first time that I have chaired this subcommittee, so I cannot answer that question. And I also can tell you that we've never had LNG applications in the state before, so until recently, and so I don't believe so. At least on this particular project.
Quick follow-up. Only thing, I wasn't really asking about LNG, just generally speaking. I didn't know if this is the way we do things generally, or we require this in some cases, according to how big the project might be, whether it's an LNG project or otherwise.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gillum, I can tell you the Department of Environmental Quality is allowed to collect reimbursements for certain costs and some other agencies, but not all agencies can ask for reimbursement of costs. So this amendment would allow all agencies to be able to collect those reimbursements. Another agency that has spent a great deal of time on this is Dogami, and Dogami is an incredibly small agency, and they have not been able to, Ms. McConnell, the director, has told me they have not been able to devote as much time as they believe the review requires simply because they don't have the staff time or the reimbursement ability.
Keep coming this direction. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think Senator Walker makes a very good point that we have a number of natural resource agencies, which are very challenged as it is right now, to be able to cover their costs. And given, if I may, Senator, I wasn't tallying the costs as you were reading them off, but do you have a rough tally by chance? That's all right. It's very significant. It's in the
It's over $1 million, yeah. Mr. Chair and Representative Witt. It's well over $1 million now at this point, in my view, and can approach much more than that as you bring on more projects and we're asked to review more projects. And the point of it is, you know, while FERC controls this process, it's just real frustrating that the federal government inserts itself into state affairs, but they do, and they're going to start doing that on transmission projects as well. So This, I believe, will help us with regard to transmission projects as well. But, you know, the state of Oregon needs to make sure that this is going to have the kind of, that we are going to protect our state assets and our environment and our water and make sure that these projects will coincide with the things that we expect here in Oregon that may be quite different than what the federal government expects.
Thank you.
Quick follow-up, please.
I think, Mr. Chairman, and I may have misheard him, but I think Joe Desmond perhaps said that his company had or was willing to cover costs for the public permitting process. I'm not exactly sure, but I thought I had heard that. And that may be of a significant help in this instance. I'm noticing that the relating clause only applies to liquefied natural gas. So I'm sure that these fees would only apply to LNG, but this may be something that we need to be considering in another bill to apply to all energy projects here in the state as we're evaluating them going forward.
Thank you, Representative Witt. Representative Benson, you have a question?
Mr. Chair, just as a remark, Bill, on the Senator's remarks, DEQ does indeed enjoy that authority, I'm sure, from other licensing situations that I have been involved in. But I the Senator did not know if it expands beyond that.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions for Senator Walker before she departs? Thank you very much, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Mr. Commissioner, thanks for your patience. Love to hear from you.
Chair Reed, committee members, happy to be here. Bob Austin, Clackamas County Commissioner. Clackamas County Board of Commissioners supports the requirement that liquid natural gas facilities and associated pipelines should only be approved if the need for such facilities in Oregon has been established, consistent with federal laws, of course, and that it also has been demonstrated that the public need outweighs the harm to private landowners. In addition, we continue to remain extremely concerned with the impact the pipelines may have on threatened and endangered species, the wild and scenic Clackamas River, recreational opportunities in the Mounted National Forest. So in January of this year, the Clackamas Board of Commissioners adopted Resolution 2009-07 in regards to the siting of liquid natural gas facilities and pipelines. And I want to read all the points in the resolution, but I'll highlight just a couple of them. We said natural gas pipelines should not be approved until state and federal agencies have conducted their thorough and objective scientific examination of the environmental benefits, consequences of alternative routes, including a rigorous evaluation of all the impacts on threatened and endangered species, wild and scenic rivers, and recreation opportunities within the national forest. We're also in support of Governor Kulongoski's direction to the state agencies to implement state regulatory requirements to the fullest extent possible to address concerns about the environmental, the social, as well as the economic impacts of any proposed pipeline and LNG projects within Oregon. So I guess I'm here in support of House Bill 2015. Clackamas County is a pretty diverse county. We have urban areas. We've got lots of healthy agricultural areas as well as a healthy tourism industry within the Mounted National Forest. So we're concerned about all of those issues, and that's why I'm here today to support this bill. So thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much. It appears that I may have missed another county commissioner who also came from 100 miles away, Jeff Hazen from Clackamas County.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Witt.
And I'd just like to recognize that Mr. Hazen is a constituent, and as you have already noted, the chair of Clackamas County Commission.
Thank you. Mr. Commissioner, sorry for missing. I think we both missed the 100-mile
That's okay.
Box.
I didn't check the box.
Thank you.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, it's an honor to be here today. The only reason I came today was just to describe the process that briefly that we went through at Clatsop County. We have two of the proposals for LNG facilities located in our county, and we went through an exhaustive review for the Bradford Landing one. This is a review, a land use process that took over 10 months. We had hearings that lasted, I think there was one day that we had a hearing.
Mr. Commissioner, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I need for you to identify yourself for the
record. I failed again.
No problem.
Jeff Hazen, Clatsop County Commissioner, Chairman.
Please go ahead.
one hearing, the long one, was held at the Liberty Theater and well over 10 hours in taking testimony. So it was a very open and transparent process. It was something that the county has never gone through before with this extensive of a land use process. One thing I did want to add was, you know, Senator Walker was talking about reimbursement for the state, and that's one thing that the county does have in place. We have a long-term financial plan that requires that we recover the cost of things. So Northern Star Natural Gas has been charged with all the fees that we've expended for that process. We generated well over 10,000 pages for the process. Last year, Commissioner Samuelson and myself traveled back to the FERC hearing in Washington, D.C., and as you heard earlier, they had over 50,000 pages of testimony and documentation. And I thought it was interesting, in that room, they did bring in the carts full of all of the testimony, so it was actually in the room. It was quite a sight to see. What it gets down to, I think that that the question that you need to ask is, do we need additional processes, additional bureaucracy? And I would just caution you with that in dealing with these. So with that, if you have any questions, I'd be more than happy to ask.
Answer?
I'm used to asking questions as a chairman. So.
Understood. We have a very short period of time, so
that's fine.
Any questions for the commissioner? Seeing none. Let's see how many more we can get in the remaining couple of minutes. The next committee is already starting to loiter a little bit. Duke Shepherd, John Ledger, Don West. Come on up, sir. And as you're getting settled, I'll call next. Evan Manvell. Who else is around that's on our list? Here comes John Ledger and Duke Shepherd. Evan, you're on deck. Your predecessors just came in. Come on, guys, and we got like. See if we can do like 1 minute apiece and how many we can get in our short remaining time. Go ahead, sir, please.
I'm Don West's boss, Robert Jacob. He couldn't come from Astoria, I could. I'd just like to say in regards to this process, there wouldn't be a need for any of this study, wouldn't be a need for any of this if we proceed ahead in something cleaner, less dangerous, less volatile, and we wouldn't have to be holding to foreign fossil fuel. I don't want to have my gas pump be Russia and the Middle East. To give you an idea, when you talk about needs and jobs, my hotel is a boutique hotel that if I knew LNG was in that county, I wouldn't have built it. I have a $10 million boutique hotel that my clients have made it pretty, I may be unsophisticated, they're not, and they said they will not come to a place that has a dirty, dangerous industrial dump where such a safe transport. To me, if it's really safe, why do you have gunships going by? Why do you have an exclusion zone if that boat blows up half of the Astoria? They don't have an exclusion zone for other freighters. And my clientele have said they come to this area because it's a sense of place, and they say it's because of Clatsop County's beauty. The whole thing to us just makes it look like we're going backwards. And just to be one quick one, Denmark didn't like the oil embargo of 73. They got a little angry. Today, 95% of all their energy is done in country, and the majority of it's all clean. And
thanks, Mr.
I was just going to say, the way you beat your 3 minutes is you leave a lot out.
Thanks very much. Gentlemen, as quickly as you can, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Ledger, Associated Oregon Industries. I'll be very brief. Oregon really needs a more diverse and robust economy. We need to provide good jobs. AOI does not support any particular LNG project, although we do support LNG. It's my understanding that there are already some LNG facilities in the state. I'm not sure. I've been told that. I haven't been aware of them decimating the population where they are yet. Anyone who thinks the DEQ permitting process is not going to be extraordinarily rigorous has never dealt with a DEQ. It will be enormous to go through, and they leave leave no stone unturned. I can tell you that. Lastly, I want to mention, you heard Lee Byron here a little earlier talking about using solar energy. And one of the things he said that was interesting was it has to be heavily subsidized, and it's quite a ways off in the future for us to get there. And we believe LNG can help us as a bridge to get there. This is good jobs, diversifies the economy. We'd like to see this industry go forward.
Thank you, Mr. Ledger. Mr. Chevron, and if you're complete, Mr. Ledger, maybe I ask somebody else to come up and we'll keep it rolling.
Sir.
As quickly as you can. Mr. Endicott, you're on our list. Shepard, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Duke Shepard with the Oregon AFL-CIO. We have about 225,000 members, union and non-union, and we support LNG in this state. Our position was a unanimous one. We have public and private sector unions who voted on that. At this time, with the unemployment we've got, this would create, Bradwood Landing would create hundreds of construction jobs over the next couple of years. And I'm trying to summarize.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
On the one hand, I would just contrast this with the meeting many of us started out in this morning. The state's putting out tax credits for a variety of energy projects that are certainly worthwhile, but without a lot of strings attached, without a lot of accountability, without necessarily any guarantee of the jobs. And yet this bill wants to create a new set of regulatory hurdles for investments that have so far complied with all the existing regulatory structures. So when we're looking at Bradwood Landing in particular, in addition to the construction jobs that will be created, we also have to look at the communities that have been impacted over the years by the loss of timber receipts, and in addition to the current economic crisis, the property taxes that will be generated are significant. Those fund local services, cops, firefighters, teachers, and we just hope you would pass on this bill, pass on acting this bill this time. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Manville.
For the record, Evan Manville, Oregon Conservation Network. Climate change is the defining issue of our generation. This bill is part of addressing climate change. Earlier, you heard comparisons of LNG to coal, and then later you heard we're actually not going to build any new coal plants, so why are we comparing it to coal? We should compare it to domestic natural gas. It's got a bigger footprint, 26% larger, according to Bradwood Landing, than domestic natural gas, increasing our dependence on high polluting fossil fuels is not just like fiddling while Rome burns with climate change, but taking the fiddle and adding it to the fire. We as a state are aiming to reduce our climate change impact, and increasing it here is totally against the policy of the state of Oregon stated in ORS 468A. That said, I think the key issue here, Mr. Desmond said, I'm not sure there is a public role. And that's what this bill is about. This bill simply says, Oregon should have a voice in these huge projects and ensure that if LNG is built here, that it protects the key interests of Oregonians. Consumer protection, global warming, protecting Oregon's agriculture, wildlife, and commercial fisheries. That is simply what the bill does. If we need it, this bill allows it. If it's clean, this bill allows it on climate change.
Thank you, Mr. Manville. And Mr. Endicott, I think you're going to have to be the last person as the next committee is ready to go. So,
Chairman, thank you very much. And committee, I'll be very brief. I've had a couple hours, and I've just practiced.
Excellent.
Spiel, but I'm going to cut it short for you.
Thank you.
I think I'll read the first paragraph. I pass the materials out to the committee. Unite Associates, and by the way, for the record, I'm John Endicott. I'm the business manager of Local 290 Plumbers and Pipe Fitters of the United States and Canada. I represent 4,400 plumbers and pipe fitters. I'm also the president of the Oregon State Building and Construction Trades Council. The UA Plumbers and Steam Fitters Local 290 opposes House Bill 2015 as a threat to our state's ailing economy that puts at risk more than 450 highly skilled, good-paying jobs. But what's at stake is broader than that. Family wage manufacturing jobs throughout Oregon depend on a reliable and affordable supply of clean-burning natural gas. We have a large, very well-trained workforce in the state of Oregon that has been trained without any state funds, that is desperate for construction jobs. I think Oregon is, by the end of the week, may reach number one in the nation for unemployment. and to have jobs that will bring resources in, help us provide more manufacturing and jobs in our state. At this time, when we're ready to go, we have a training center in Astoria, we have a training center in Coos Bay, we have 11 throughout the state, and we are ready to build this plant. It's a shovel-ready project. And to be delayed 5 years so far is just unheard of in this bureaucracy. And I'll hold it and hope that this lets you know the construction industry does not support this bill.
Thank you very much. I really apologize to the audience that we've run out of time. Appreciate your presence here, doing our best to get through as many people as we could, with an emphasis on the folks who had come from a long distance and trying to hear the balanced perspective. I'd encourage folks who are interested, we'd be happy to have your written testimony since we've run out of time. And if there aren't any other general comments, quickly, Representative Witt.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you. I've heard several times the claim that these are not going to be Oregon jobs associated with LNG in Oregon. We have the unions here that are going to be doing that work. Union jobs are not, and how do you know?
Pardon me, Representative Witt.
Are these going to be, the jobs that are created, are they going to be for Oregon workers, or are they going to be for somebody someplace else? And,
how do you know that? With the Jordan Cove and the Bradwood individuals, yes. And those will be local workers, and we have the trained people on the ground ready to go.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, committee. Thank you, members of the public. That will close the public hearing on House Bill 2015 and adjourn the committee.
Good.